I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. For six seasons, millions of viewers tuned to their local PBS station to watch the latest installment of Downton Abbey, the upstairs, downstairs world of the Crawleys and their many servants living in a sprawling castle in the British countryside. While the series ended a few years ago, the characters have been revived for the Downton Abbey movie that opens today. The time is 1927, and King George V and Queen Mary are spending the night at Downton. The Crawley family and their staff are in a frenzy getting the place ready for the royal visit. Earlier this week, I sat down with three members of the cast before a packed crowd of Downton fans at WHYY to talk about the characters they play and the Downton phenomenon. Let me introduce them to you.
Jim Carter, who plays Mr. Carson, now the world's most famous butler. Has been acting since the 1970s, beginning with a fringe theater group, and playing in a wide range of characters on TV and in movies, including The Singing Detective, The Madness of King George, Shakespeare in Love, and most recently, The Good Liar, which opens later this fall. Kevin Doyle plays Mr. Mosley, or as we know him, poor Mr. Mosley. The nervous and self-effacing footman, valet butler, has had a successful career appearing in movies and on TV, including most recently as Detective John Wadsworth in the murder mystery series Happy Valley. Imelda Staunton plays a new character, Lady Bagshaw, created for the movie. She's a cousin of Lord Grantham. She has a deep, dark secret. She spars with the Dowager Countess. Imelda Staunton has had a long and distinguished acting career on stage and screen. I should add that she has terrified Harry Potter fans with her portrayal of the evil Dolores Umbridge. In real life, Jim Carter and Imelda Staunton are married to each other. Mr. Carson, I'll begin with you, Jim Carter. What do you think explains not just the enthusiasm for this series, but the almost mania for this series?
If I could answer that in one sentence, I'd be happy to. There's no single explanation, I don't think. It's nostalgic, it's romantic, it's uncynical, it's harking back to a time that we portray as a time when people were secure in their roles and happy in their roles. And in a world now that's very fractured, I think people like to go back to that and feel safe. It's a show that you can feel safe with. You know you're not going to be threatened, it's not going to be violent, there's no men with guns going to come hurtling through the door. It's all those things, but that explains part of its success. But the fervour, I blame firmly on Americans. I'm sorry.
Is there more fervor in America, you think, than in Britain?
There is, I think. But maybe it's because you're more open and generous with your, you know, the way you approach us and the way that you approach the thing. Or maybe it means a little bit more over here. Maybe it's taps into a nostalgia for another time over here. And we're in England, we're very familiar with the class system. It's something that's just ingrained in our DNA. It's slightly more exotic, I think, for you, the manners and the mores of the English upper class, which we show in a certain... We try to get the detail of their life right, and I think that's sort of fascinatingly, sort of bizarrely exotic, the way people are so obsessed with the way a table is set or the way somebody dresses or behaves or whether they wear white gloves or a waistcoat.
I wonder also whether you have regrets about 1776.
Well, I was going to ask you...
I put it out there.
From your perspective, you think a kind of a nostalgia, a longing in this country for... where people knew their place.
Yes, perhaps.
Well, I think what's so interesting as an American is looking at this house where you've got the upper class, the lower class, you've got the upstairs and the downstairs, but living, and I'm looking at you, Kevin, living so closely together, there is a kind of intimacy that's really striking.
There is. I mean, I think it's sort of... it's kind of summed up in the relationship, I think, between Mr. Carson and Lady Mary. Like a surrogate father. I think relationships like that, I mean, you know, we're looking back with rose-tinted glasses. You know, it was a hard life for characters like Mr. Molesley and characters like Anna. And of course, the relationship between Anna and Bates would never have been allowed to happen. You know, they led very restricted lives. And as a consequence, I think, you know, a lot of unhappy lives as well. Thwarted ambition
It's a relationship of complete sort of symbiosis, really.
Absolutely.
I mean, the job of the downstairs staff is to make the life of the upstairs people perfect, and it's a machine that has to run perfectly. And Mr. Carson's job is to make sure that that happens. And we had a historical advisor who gave us very good advice. He said, you know, upstairs is the stage. Downstairs is backstage. We are the stage managers. We make it perfect. When we're out in the light, it's perfect. So if Lord Grantham leaves the library and leaves a newspaper on the floor and a cushion unplumped, by the time he walks back, that cushion is plumped. The newspaper is folded and life is perfect. And no, it's invisible.
But can I just say, as an outsider who's come in, but what you also are dealing with are the head of the households. You've got Lord Grantham and, say, Carson downstairs, who are both honourable men. And I think that's what people also take in, because it's not a tyrant, Lord Grantham.
He's not.
And I think he wants to do his best and he wants to be compassionate. And I think people yearn for those sort of people who make good decisions. And also act for the good of others and also do their duty, regardless. And of course it's tough downstairs, of course it is, and it's a different type of problem you've got upstairs.
Well, it seems doing your duty, but also knowing which fork to use.
Yeah. Which is
and
essential.
How important that is.
Yes, I mean, it's ridiculous, obviously.
Some of the things we learnt about the manners of the time, we learnt one thing, there's at a formal dinner, not a family dinner, a formal dinner, all the female guests would look at Lady Cora and see which way she turned. And if she turned to the left, all the women would turn to the left and talk to the man on their left for the first two courses. And then they would, for the dessert course, they would turn to the right and talk to them. So nobody could, it was too far to talk across a table. And so there were these very formal strictures to the manners of the time.
But there
which were
reasons
obeyed.
For that, weren't there? There were reasons for that.
There were reasons for it, yes.
So no one was left out. No one was left with no one to talk to.
Yes. So you could be a really dull person and go have a great dinner because some woman on your right's going to talk to you.
You English are so polite. It's phenomenal. Let me play a clip from the movie. And in this scene, Lady Mary, played by Michelle Dockery, asks you, Mr. Carson, to come back to Downton to help prepare for the King and Queen's visit. I should add, towards the end of the TV series, Carson got married to Mrs. Hughes, played by Phyllis Logan. They moved to a cottage. He had to step down from being the Downton butler because he was having tremors, so Thomas Barrow took over. Let's play a scene from the movie Downton Abbey.
Carson.
My lady, please come in.
This is an honour.
I don't want to be a nuisance, but I need your help, Carson. Barrow just isn't up to the task.
My lady?
He won't clean the silver, or he won't let Andrew clean it.
What?
He says the page of the thingamy will choose which pieces to use.
I see.
The truth is, he's in a sort of trance. Won't you help me? I feel I'm pushing a rock uphill.
I'll be there in the morning, my lady. Don't you worry.
You're a treasure, Carson. That's all there is to say. I'll see myself out.
You could never refuse her anything.
Such a great eye roll there, isn't it? It says a lot.
See, the lovely thing about seeing it on the screen,
yes,
is sort of having that kind of reaction with a large audience. which, of course, you won't normally have experienced because you're watching it at home with your family and friends. But to see this, and we saw it recently at the premiere in New York, to sort of see it with several hundred people around, is, well, it reminds you just how popular the show is, but it's a fantastic communal experience as well.
It's a treat for us, wasn't it?
Yeah, oh, yes, yes.
I think it would be very nice for people to see it in the cinema because even the reaction you have today, that's a lovely feeling, which we don't go to the cinema in crowds anymore. But if you've got this fan base that you guys have created, that I'm just coming in on, but it's really a delicious feeling to hear that, to have that joined reaction.
Well, like theatre, right?
Yes.
When you're in the theatre.
Yeah.
But seeing that scene and watching Downton Abbey, to you, Jim Carter, I always wondered what is his inner life? Who is he inside himself?
Well, it's funny because he's a sort of a factotum. A butler was a respected position within a household. A butler never got married. A housekeeper didn't get married. They were married to the job, to the family, utterly dependent on the family, totally loyal. And Carson's the keeper of the flame, really. He's the one who keeps everybody up to the mark with, this is how we behave, this is how things work, everything has to be done correctly. So it's a treat. For the character and for me as an actor, when you just see a little bit behind the mask, when you see that he's got this affection for Lady Mary, he's known, the girls, Mary, Edith and Sybil, since they were tiny, and he's got a particular affection for the eldest. And then in the television series, you see him, his heart slowly melting, and over four seasons, about 44 episodes, getting together with Mrs. Hughes. He's not a fast mover, isn't Carson,
Unlike life.
Yeah, we'll get to that, yeah. I promise.
Met her, married her. So it's a delight to see within that. I think it'd be a very lonely life being a butler. He can't be friends with the upstairs people, really, and his status is too high to make friends downstairs. I think he'd get one afternoon off a fortnight and wouldn't know what to do with himself. So, as I say, to see those little moments of personal moments are great, and they're only little chinks into the inside of the man.
What happened to his tremor, though?
His tremor was miraculously solved, I think, by rest and relaxation, a little bit of gardening.
Some gardening, probably.
It was a wonder. It never got mentioned again. I don't know if it's a medical fact that it got solved like that, but it worked for us.
We never see you pouring wine, though, do we?
We don't see him pouring wine.
More about Downton Abbey after a short break. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to a special edition of Radio Times, taped this week before a sold-out crowd of Downton Abbey fans at WHYY. The movie version of the popular PBS series opens today. Our guests are Jim Carter, who plays Mr. Carson, the imposing head butler at Downton. Kevin Doyle plays Mr. Molesley, who's been a butler, valet, and footman at Downton. And Imelda Staunton, who plays a new character for the movie Lady Bagshaw, who's not afraid to tangle with a sharp-tongued Dowager Countess, played by Maggie Smith.
Kevin, let me talk about your character, Mr. Molesley. Poor Mr. Molesley. He started kind of small in the TV series, as I understand. The first season was a smaller role than I think he became.
Oh, yes. He wasn't meant to be a continuing character. He was there to sort of introduce Matthew Crawley and his mum to that world. So he was their butler. And so I don't know what the thinking was in terms of where it was going to go, but I was told early on that he would be there for maybe two or three episodes and then, see what happens.
And here you are.
So it evolved, over the seasons. And at the beginning, he was rather a dour character, took himself very seriously, and, felt the humiliation of Matthew not requiring his services and things like that. And then, as Jim said, sort of over the years, Julian sort of responded to what I could offer, and the character sort of slowly became more three-dimensional, I think.
Oh, why is he so nervous?
Why, in general?
Yes.
It depends on the circumstance.
You're enthusiastic, aren't
yes,
you?
I think so, yes. He's a strange man. I love him dearly, actually.
I think we all do love
Kevin,
him dearly.
Kevin, he is yes. You. You know. Don't talk about him in the third person, mate. You are he and he is you.
And I am nervous, so there you go. There's your answer.
There is also great humor and comedy in your performance as well. I mean, as much as we feel for you, there's also humor in what you bring to this character.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm pleased. That was a really interesting season, actually, because we learned towards the end of season three that we were losing Dan Stevens, who played Matthew, and so some of us were a little trepidatious about our futures within the show, because if there's no Matthew, then there's no reason for Molesley to be around, and I thought the producers and Julian took a really interesting decision to sort of, to explore, then what happens to somebody in that situation? And so you find that his world is suddenly uncertain. You know, that was going to be his life for the foreseeable, and suddenly that's removed. And so you see him undergoing sort of hardship and having to accept the humiliation of stepping down from, as Julian wrote so beautifully, he's having his career backwards. So he starts off as a butler, and then he becomes a valet, and then he becomes a footman, having to wear gloves, for crying out loud. it's a beautiful path. And so he had to endure this sort of public humiliation of sort of...
I just wish, this follows on that he does, it's not giving anything away because it was in the TV series, that he does become a footman. And I wish the cameras had been on us when Kevin first came up into the dining room, because before that he'd never served in the dining room. Me and Mr. Barrow, we'd put in some years up there. And it was sort of quite hard work for us, because the family were sitting down and we were serving them. It had to be very carefully choreographed that comes in from the right, food comes in from the left. The footmen keep two guests between them as they go around the table serving immaculately. Well, Kevin was completely at sea, and Rob James Collier, Mr. Barrow, were grabbing him, pushing him, pulling him out of the way. And that's when you were perfectly Mr. Molesley. I'm sorry to disappoint, Kevin.
Because the service is meant to be invisible, you only notice it when it's going wrong, because the point of that invisible service was to allow the conversation around the table to sort of flow, and so anybody getting in the way of that was sort of.
And one more question before we get to Lady Bagshaw, Mr. Moles he's a royalist. I mean, he has this deep affection for the royal family, correct?
Yes, which I hadn't realised until I read the script. the main thrust of the movie's storyline is the royal visit, and you have to realise that back then, 1927, the idea of a royal visit would have been a sort of a once in a generation thing. But the reason that they started to do that was there was a lot of disenchantment in the country after the First World War. The royal family felt disconnected from society, and we just had the general strike, and so there was a lot of political discontent and societal discontent, and so they were advised to, rather than sort of hunker down and stay in London, they should go out into the country. Mm-hmm. And sort of, so that's why they started to do the royal tours. And so part of that royal tour is visiting Downton. And so certainly the downstairs staff would never have seen them in the flesh before. you know, their only experience of the royal family would be listening to the King's speech on Christmas Day on the radio. That would be it. And, you know, there's no television or anything like that. So the prospect of a royal visit is just so thrilling, not only to the county, not only to the village, but the house itself, everybody, apart from one or two exceptions, are thrilled at the prospect of seeing them in the flesh and serving.
To help put it into context, I mean, the royal family, they were so huge celebrities because they were so remote. And even in for many of us, people of my generation, the first time we saw television, the first time I saw television was 1953, so 26 years after this fictional programme. And we travelled 60 miles to my great-uncle's house to watch the coronation of the Queen and Prince Philip on television. And we crowded into a room watching a little greenish sort of bowl like this, all the curtains drawn because it was so faded, and there were probably 40 members of the family in one room watching this thing because these people were so remote. It was so glamorous and exciting, this little grainy black and white image. And this is 26 years after the thing we're portraying in the film here. So that's the scale of how momentous a visit from the royal family was.
So let's talk about Lady Bagshaw, who was introduced in this movie. How do you see her, Imelda Staunton?
I can't tell you too much, but I'll tell you a little bit. So I arrive with the royal household, as I am a lady-in-waiting, but I have a secret, and it will affect the family. That's really all I can really say. But it was what was wonderful was, A, it was such a shock to be asked to be part of the film, but then to have a really strong storyline was great, and that I get to work, you know, my scenes with, you know, Dame Penelope and Dame Maggie. It was like having, you know, Federer and Nadal. So that's what it was like. I was the ball girl, but quite happily. So it was it's a wonderful part, but I'm aware, you know, I also what people want are the regular characters, and I, you know, of course, and that's what the fans want. But I think this story is quite a little interesting strand.
Oh, I think we were very happy to see you arrive on the scene. Let me play another scene from the film. In this scene, Violet Crawley, played by Maggie Smith, wants to talk to Lady Bagshaw about who will inherit her estate. Lady Bagshaw, played by our guest, Imelda Staunton, is a cousin of the Crawleys, a lady-in-waiting to the Queen. Her maid, Lucy Smith, is played by Tuppence Middleton. Let's give it a listen.
How clever of you to find me.
Well, not really. I lived here 40 years. I assume this is your maid?
Yes, this is Lucy Smith.
Oh, good evening, Smith.
Good evening, milady. Shall I go?
No, not for me. Not for me. I'm delighted to meet you. I've heard so much about you.
Is there something you want?
Oh, just to see you're comfortable and to confirm our little chat for later.
I live my own life now, Violet. I'm not what I was. My father is gone. My husband is gone. I see no reason not to do what I want.
Well, that doesn't mean there is no reason. Merely that you cannot see it.
I think Lady Merton is right. We'll have it out once and for all. But now I must go to Her Majesty.
Take that, Dowager Countess, right?
What?
Yes. Take that, Dowager Countess.
Yes.
But I know that you're friends with Maggie Smith. Mm. I mean, these are women that you know well. What was it like to be part of that trio?
Well, what do you think?
It doesn't get
better than that, you know. Yes, I do feel incredibly privileged to be in the film and be working with those two actresses who I have worked with and obviously admired for a couple of hundred years. So it's, you know, and you want to, and, you know, you're coming into something that's already hugely successful, so you want to, you know, you've got to be match fit and you don't want to drop the ball. I'm not sporty at all. I don't know why I keep making these references.
You want to knock it out of the park?
Yes, I do.
Take one for the home team. Is that,
yes, I do.
Keep going, love. Keep going. You're doing well, yeah.
You're in Philadelphia. Those sports metaphors always work.
Yeah. No, it was glorious, obviously.
Imelda's too modest to say, but Michael Engler, our director, who's an American, who just left us to fly off to L.A., I think, said that when they were looking for someone to play Lady Maud Bagshaw, they needed someone who could stand up to Maggie Smith. Ah. And Imelda's the person. But she would never say that.
Well, one thing I always loved about Downton Abbey were the clothes that the women got to wear. I know mostly the men, you were all in uniforms.
The same thing for six years, thank you very much. Yeah.
But for you, you got to wear these fabulous outfits.
I mean, of course, we're all aware of it now because people talk about the making of things. But you all know that behind the scenes, as in the downstairs and down, the work that goes on, and the costume designer Anna Robbins and her brilliant assistant Kat, actually. I remember one day there's a ball scene, and I had a beautiful outfit, and I had little, which they had, it's all handmade, for goodness sake. Oh. So, and there were little, tiny little buttons down the arm of the sleeve, and little Kat came and said, "No, those buttons, they're in the wrong place." And I thought, oh, well, they've got to move. No, she moved them a quarter of an inch so that the line on this shape, you just see these little tiny buttons. And you go, well, for goodness sake. And they're passionate about the work they do, as hopefully we are as passionate about the work we do. And you take your hat off to them because they are there before anyone else in the morning and they leave at practically midnight. They're like little elves who spend the whole night making things. Huh. And to be wearing those clothes, and of course it makes all the difference.
Well, I wanted to ask about that, about how the clothing helps you understand the character.
Yeah, well, Well, I'm sitting quite nicely, actually, I have to say. But the boys wouldn't be sitting like that. but it does, it makes you feel authentic, which is what, you have to feel.
It was a very formal time. Nobody slouched. We were told we couldn't put hands in pockets. Hugh Bonneville, Lord Grantham, put his hands in his pockets. They had to reshoot the scene. For the second series, he had his pockets sewn up. So, yeah. You couldn't cross your legs. I'm looking at the front row here.
Mr. Mosley again.
Yeah.
Right.
The backs of chairs were not for slouching against. They were for servants to pull out the chair and push in the chair. But the costumes dictated a lot of character. Because they're so formal, when we're trussed into our starched waistcoats and our high collars, you can only stand upright. Yes. You can only be formal. It's a formal period, and the costumes dictated that. The women were pulled into corsets.
Yeah. That sort of evolved over the years, didn't it? Because the series started in 1912, yeah. And everybody was very corseted up, especially the young women. But as the years progressed, you could sort of see that kind of relaxation, couldn't you, in the costumes?
It was a brilliant period to place it for women's fashions, because the transformation from 1912, where they were still in Victorian clothing, really, through into the roaring 20s, and we had this genius costume, well, a couple of genius costume designers who really flew with that. Mm.
Kevin, talk about the house, the home. I mean, what it was like to operate out of that incredible castle.
Well, you have to know that only some of it was filmed at the castle.
Right.
All the sort of the big public rooms, like the dining room and the library and the drawing room and the main central hallway. So all of the grand upstairs rooms were filmed at the castle. And we had to be very careful about what we could and couldn't do in there. And all of the downstairs stuff was filmed... For the TV show, it was filmed at Ealing Studios in West London, and then for the movie, it was shot at Shepperton. And some of the bedrooms as well, just because there's a lot of big machinery when you're shooting something
sure.
like that to move around, and the bedrooms upstairs certainly were too delicate to allow that kind of stuff in there. So Sometimes you would start a scene downstairs. When we were shooting the TV series, you'd start a scene downstairs, and 3 weeks later you would complete the scene upstairs. Yeah, you
and
come up the stairs.
And stitch it all together.
Yeah, yeah.
But we were shadowed everywhere we went, almost by the shadow staff of Highclere Castle, because we weren't allowed to move any of their priceless bits of furniture or porcelain lamps or put anything on the table. So their housekeeper would come out with the gloves and move the particular piece, you know, for safety reasons. And we got friendly with them. Lovely Diana, the head housekeeper there.
But, you know, in the dining room, there's a Van Dyck painting on the wall, which is apparently worth £17 million. So, you know, you have to be very careful with cameras
right.
and lighting.
A lot of security there, I guess.
In the library, there are sort of priceless books, so you're just aware of...
And the house is the star of the film, and the TV, it's a major character, isn't it? You know, really, Highclere Castle stroke Downton Abbey is a big character. And I would stand out front as the butler, and I could look out... over this crowded little island we called England, we used to call England, I don't know what it's called now, Bringland. And I could stand there and not see another dwelling at all, you know. It was really their own world, their own domain.
You mentioned Bringland. Julian Fellowes, I saw a quote where he said, the Downton film is so everyone can take 2 hours off of Brexit.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. The only B word you'll hear is Branson.
That's Jim Carter, who plays Mr. Carson in the PBS and Now movie version of Downton Abbey. He and two other cast members, Kevin Doyle and Imelda Staunton, joined us earlier this week at a sold-out audience event at WHYY. After this short break, we'll hear how our guests became actors. Stay with us. I'm Marty Moscoene, and you're listening to an interview I taped earlier this week with some of the cast of Downton Abbey, both the series and the movie that opens today. Kevin Doyle plays Mr. Molesley, Jim Carter plays Mr. Carson, and in real life is married to Imelda Staunton, who plays a new character, Lady Bagshaw. In this final segment of our interview, we play a scene from the TV show when Mr. Carson finally pops the question. Let me play one more clip, and I hope you brought your hankies. This is the end of the fifth season. It's Christmas Eve. Mr. Carson finally proposes to Mrs. Hughes, played by Phyllis Logan. Let's give it a watch.
Suppose you want to move away and change your life entirely. You don't want to be stuck with me.
But that's the point.
What is?
I do want to be stuck with you.
I'm not convinced I can be hearing this right.
You are, if you think I'm asking you to marry me. Well?
Well, you could knock me down with a feather.
And you're not offended?
Oh, Mr. Carson, I can assure you the very last thing in the world that I am at this moment is offended.
You can take as long as you like. I won't press you, because one thing I do know, I'm not marrying anyone else.
Well, then.
What exactly are we celebrating?
We're celebrating the fact that I can still get a proposal at my age.
And that's it?
Of course I'll marry you, you old booby. I thought you'd never ask.
Yay! I always wondered, after you got married, were you still Mr. Carson and she was still Mrs. Hughes, as you called each other?
Yeah.
Oh, that never changed.
I think we tried to call each other Charlie and Elsie, but it didn't seem right. I mean, there's a fan group called the Chelseas, Charlie and Elsie, who like us as a couple. But again, that's the formality of it.
What I could never figure out is why Mrs. Patmore was called Mrs. Patmore and she was never married. Why?
Because they were. The cook was always called Mrs. Bridges, Mrs. Patmore. The butler, the housekeeper, and the cook were never married. You know, as I think I mentioned earlier, they were married to the job. So, but they were called Mrs. And Mrs. And yeah.
I heard a quote from you, or I read a quote from you, Imelda Staunton, that at home, with your husband here, that you're Mrs. Patmore because you're the person who cooks.
Yes, I am. Yes, he does pour the wine and set the table.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, and washes up.
Yeah.
Well, I feel
and does
since...
the gardening. So we both do that.
And we share the gardening duties.
Yeah, we do.
That's our favorite. That's our passion.
Well, in fact, you just opened a new garden, or a garden has been opened that you were involved in for a hospice centre. Did I read that correctly?
Yes, we're both patrons of a children's hospice, but also patrons of an organisation called Green Fingers, who make gardens for children's hospices. So we just opened that garden recently.
I saw pictures of
it. Oh, it was lovely.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, really great. Yeah.
Well, since we saw this marriage proposal, we should find out about... what happened between the two of you? You met on the set of Guys and Dolls?
We did indeed.
Were you Adelaide?
Well, no, I became Adelaide. I was a hatbox girl first. And, and Jim
Tell
was...
Tell them what you thought on January the 4th, 1982, at the read-through, Imelda.
All right. So we were all sat down at the read-through, and I was just sort of looking around, and I looked around, and I saw Jim. I thought, ooh, who's that old bloke? You know, and he's, you know, and I thought, isn't it funny when you're young, you think someone even 3 years older than you is a lot older than you. But then we spent a year in that company doing two other shows as well, and then got together at the end of that year.
Yeah. And were you Nathan Detroit? Or?
I was Big Julie, the gangster from Chicago. Yeah,
of course.
Plays craps or spats with no dice with no spats on them.
Oh, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
It's gone. It's a miracle. I was in a musical. I can't sing a note. And as for tap dancing, forget it.
You did it.
So what was your impression of her when you first met her?
Once I'd looked through the forest of leggy blondes and I'd spotted Imelda. We grew. It was a wonderful way to get together because we were working together, so we became friends, and we got together sort of organically. We became friends, and then there was a moment in a rehearsal where I think you saw me sort of looking at you and just...
Oh, that's weird.
Something clicked, didn't it?
Yeah, no, that was really weird. So we were doing just a dance rehearsal, and he was just watching us, and for us... 3 seconds, I looked and I thought, that man wants to marry me.
Oh. Really?
Then it went away, because we didn't get together for a year later, but it was an absolute flash. And
Imelda was involved in another relationship, and then when we did sort of, you know, get together, it was we were married within sort of 10 months of sort of going out with each other, because we just knew it was right, and 35 and a half years later, it's still right. So
that's great.
That's right. And a lot to do with humour, I have to say. It is, and well, obviously respect, but humour plays quite a large part in our lives.
I think
lives.
We got a flavour for that today. How did you get into acting, Kevin? How far back do we have to go?
So the war had just finished.
I got into it by default, really. I had no idea what I was going to do with my life, and some friends were interested in... putting on plays, and I had one shot at going into a drama school, and I thought, well, I'll take that one shot, and I didn't think that I would go beyond that one shot. So, unfortunately, they accepted me. But if they hadn't, I've absolutely no idea what I'd be doing now. I didn't have any... And I think it's quite a common story for actors, actually. I think it kind of saved me, because I didn't have any... ambition to go to university or anything like that. So I was, it saved me.
It saved you from what?
Well, from an uncertain future. A bit like Mr. Molesley, I suppose. I didn't take the decision. The decision was taken for me. So they accepted me, and so I went. I've been lucky to sort of stick with it.
And are there certain kinds of characters you look to play, or looks? I looked at your bio; it covers a range. I would say.
I was known for a while playing sort of rather sadistic killers. So when Mr. Molesley came along, it was sort of it was a nice change. this quiet.
You don't seem like quite the type. I'm just saying.
Most sadistic killers are.
What ones you have to worry about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So and I'd been doing sort of primarily working in theatre up until this point as well. Yeah. In fact, when I got the interview for Downton Abbey, this thing called Downton Abbey, it was a bit of an inconvenience because I was opening a play at the National Theatre at the time, and I could have really done without having to sort of schlep over to Ealing Studios to sort of meet the director, and because I was kind of focused on opening this play. So, but I was, as I said earlier, I'd been told it was only going to be a couple of episodes, so it wasn't going to be any. Right. The idea of sort of filming during the day and doing a play in the evening, sort of, ooh, now that's too much hard work.
And here you are.
And here
it is. I read that you, Jim Carter, you were in university, and it was your start was in Fringe and then later comedy, correct?
Yeah. I went to university to read law. Took one look at the law books and changed to English. and then did some children's theatre on the beach in Brighton in the late 60s in a very hippie sort of way. And a little fringe theatre group was starting up in Brighton. And I did something with them as an amateur. And then they offered me a job for £5 a week, food and a bed. And I weighed that up against a career in the law, and I took that offer. It was with no thought or hesitation. I just knew with total clarity it was the right thing to do. But because I'd sort of turned my back on a fair bit of education, I made a pledge to myself I would only ever earn my living as an actor or an entertainer. And I think I saw myself more as an entertainer in those days. Yeah. So I taught myself to juggle and to unicycle, to walk tight ropes. I taught myself magic, and I...
A bit like Mr. Carson.
Very like Mr. Carson. Well, he had a career in the vaudeville.
Yes.
But then I was here. Is anybody here old enough to remember the 70s? Yes, I can tell. I was in Philadelphia in 1976 at a kind of a hippie music venue called Grendel's Lair.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. And we, in 1976, the bicentenary year, we played 3 months at Grendel's Lair in a kind of comedy cabaret called the Madhouse Company of London in the Wild Stunt Show, a wild vaudevillian comedy show, and had a very hot sort of summer here, and I had a wonderful time. So this is the first time I've been back since.
Oh, well, that's terrific. All the Harry Potter fans want to know about Dolores Umbridge and the evil character that you play.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was, I joined a franchise. I was in the fifth film. That's right. So, of course, we'd read the books to our daughter, and I remember, and we hadn't got to the fifth book, and I remember a friend phoned us up and said, "Oh my goodness, there's an amazing part for you in the fifth book." I said, "Oh, right." And then, so I opened the book, and in she comes, short, fat, ugly, toad-like woman.
Oh, no.
Thank you. He's no longer on the Christmas card list, I'm having to tell you. But so it was wonderful to go in, because also the director of the fifth film was his first time on the Potter films, and we had long talks about this character who seemingly is a bit silly but she's not a good person
and she is
at
not
all
a good person.
And should not be in charge of children, should not be given any responsibility at all, but also a very serious character, and as he said, look, there's no point in having all these special effects if the people aren't frightening. The people need to be more frightening than the monsters, because we are. So that was really good to work on.
Let me read some questions from the audience. A question for you, Kevin. We enjoyed your work in Happy Valley and Scott and Bailey. Your characters don't ever seem to get a happy ending. We were happy about where Mr. Mosley ended up at the end of Downton TV run. Without giving up, giving too much away, will he still be happy at the end of the movie?
There's the possibility of happiness. As there always is, Mr. Mosley, there's the possibility.
Because you live on, so there is a possibility.
There's no resolution to your happiness.
There never will be. No matter how many sequels there are, there never will be.
The Eternal Quest of Joseph Mosley.
Mr. Carson, to me, is the voice of Downton Abbey and the voice of reason and high standards. Where did you draw your character from in your research?
Well, I'm very lucky. The butler is a kind of an iconic role, in certainly in English literature, with P.G. Woodhouse and Jeeves, and English TV with Upstairs, Downstairs, with films with Remains of the Day, Anthony Hopkins, and John Gielgud in Arthur, was it, and Denham Elliott in Trading Places. So they'd done all the work for me, really, and I just stood on their shoulders, put on the costume, and I was there, really. I didn't have to do a lot of research. Our historical advisor told us about our bearing and our... And that did a lot of the work for me. And, of course, we're performing in a world that Julian Fellowes is very comfortable with, and it's his world. So it was all there in the script, so there wasn't a lot of specific research.
It's so interesting because the series ended several years ago, and then now there's a movie. Was it an effort to sort of have the cast wrap-up party, put it all to bed, and then to revive it as a movie?
Well, I think there'd been sort of... whispers about the possibility of a film, and I think some people have been sounded out, if there was a film, would you want to do it? But it was only whispers. But the momentum for the film was driven, I think, partly by the media. Every interview we did, whatever the subject, always ended up with people turning off the microphone and saying, now, is it going to be a Downton film? And that never abated. It never diminished. So the appetite was there. And I think that was probably the driver for the film. I don't think there would be an appetite to do another TV series, because that's 11 hours. So this is the film is a blown-up cinematic version of the television series, with all the same elements, driven by the fans and that expectation. And judging by the reaction that the film's already had, it was the right decision to do. And I think Julian Fellowes, the director and the producers, have effectively got all those elements that you like about the programme onto the film and just given it sort of slightly more swagger and a bit more cinematic grandeur. And hopefully, when those of you who haven't seen it, presumably most of you, when you do go and see it, you'll enjoy that.
Well, I had more questions, but I think that's the perfect place to end our conversation. My thanks to all three of you for joining us. My thanks to our audience for being here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was Jim Carter, Kevin Doyle, and Imelda Staunton at WHYY earlier this week. Debbie Builder produced today's interview. It was edited by John Ahrens with assistance from Kelsey Hansen. Engineering help from Joyce Lieberman, Paul Parmley, Adam Stanishevsky, Andrew Arcangeli, and Diana Martinez. Special thanks to Emily Kinslow and the WHYY member relations team. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.